interesting. Danielle laughed when I almost shrieked when she said, we'd like to have you talk about building a better budget. And the reason I was so excited about this is I'm 43 and I have struggled my entire life with weight. And so I think about everything in terms of weight analogies. And when you're trying to become physically healthy, what does a doctor tell you? You have two levers you can pull. You can eat less and you can exercise more. And it's the same thing with personal finance. Your two levers are spend less or earn more. And in the economic environment that we've been facing lately, earning more takes a little bit longer. It's definitely doable. But the one thing that we can all control right now is spending less. And that's why I love budgeting. The second reason I love budgeting is because I think about it very differently than most folks. And my goal here today is to leave you with three key takeaways that will hopefully inspire you to think about it differently too. And the key point that I would make on that front is that I think about the word budgeting as maximizing joy. In other words, you work hard to earn your money, and the whole point of budgeting is to make sure that your money isn't wiggling out into places in life that aren't bringing you extreme joy. And I find that when people make that shift, when they realize how powerful the lever of spending is, it's the one thing you can control. Nobody can take that from you. Combined with the fact that it's not depriving yourself, it's maximizing your joy. Hopefully, as we flow through the conversation today, you might become a little bit obsessed with budgeting the way I am. That's my goal for the day.
What would you say the state of the average person's finances are right now?
So if this room were full of folks right at the point of average in America, this is what our collective finances, this is what we would all look like. 75% of us would be living paycheck to paycheck. We would not be able to cover our living expenses for 6 months if we lost our job. If we had credit card debt, our average debt collectively in this room, if we were average, would be $7,000. If we had student loans, we would carry an average of $30,000 in student loans. There'd be a 1 in 8 chance our student loans are over $50,000. And on the retirement front, if we were an average group of Americans, all of us in this room, 80% of us would not be on track to retire at 65 at our current standard of living. 45% of us wouldn't even have started saving for retirement, and 55% of us wouldn't have ever used a retirement calculator. We're driving blind. We have no idea how much we need to strive for. And so I highlight those statistics because one of the things I think people feel when it comes to their personal finances is really alone. Like, you're the only one that's struggling. And when you look at those average statistics, you can see the vast majority of us are struggling right now. And so I like to put that out first and foremost because I find that there's a lot of shame and embarrassment and frustration with yourself if you are struggling with your personal finances. And it's not something that we chat about like other areas that we struggle with our girlfriends and family members. So hopefully the point of telling you those numbers is to know if you identified with any one of them, you're not alone.
So why do you think it's so difficult, the budgeting and saving, even for, I consider myself to be somewhat competent and successful, but my grocery bill is just astronomical.
So I think there are three reasons. And of all the answers I give, this one may be the longest, but I'm going on because I think, like any problem you have, if you can get to the root source, I've been struggling a lot lately with workaholism, and I've tried all sorts of things to box my workaholism. I'm spending too much time on work rather than spending too much money on hair products. And I was trying to rein my workaholism in by setting arbitrary deadlines. Stop working at this time. Make sure you take this amount of vacation. But my mind kept going. And finally, I had to get to the root. The reason that I was working so much is because I felt that I was my work and I didn't have any sense of self that wasn't tied to my identity at work. Once that light bulb switched, it was still hard work. I still had a lot of behaviors to change, but I was able to move forward. And it's the same thing with understanding budgeting. So here are the three things that lead budgeting to be so difficult when we're in the grocery store or we're out shopping or with our kids. Number one, no one taught us about this stuff. The vast majority of us never had a formal education in personal finance. And that wasn't problematic 50 years ago when our parents were growing up, because there were institutional safeguards to save you from yourself. If you wanted to buy a home way back when, you only had one kind of mortgage. It was a 30-year fixed. You had to put 20% down. If you wanted to get a credit card, you couldn't just go to your mailbox in your PJs. You had to go down to the bank. You had to dress up. You had to talk to a professional in the financial services industry and look him in the eye, because back then it would have been a him, and explain how you're going to pay it back. Today, it's a completely different ball game. So the reason number one is we weren't educated. Reason number two is that there's been a proliferation of financial products, and now we have to make the choice what to do, but we weren't given education. It's like somebody handed us an Uzi, and we shot ourselves in the financial foot because we didn't know how to use it. And then the third reason, and I think this one may be the biggest, is that we're bombarded by unrealistic media images. I'm addicted to all the police and medical dramas, so I can't help but notice every time I watch Law & Order reruns or Grey's Anatomy, have you noticed that every nurse and every policewoman is showing up for her 7 a.m. shift, and she's clearly just had, like we've had, like hair and makeup and a blowout and a perfect mani-pedi. So we're seeing these images of what average is that are anything but. And I have a hunch that if you were to add up the grooming costs of any character at any level, from an administrative assistant all the way up to a CEO that we see on TV, if you were to add up the lifestyle depicted in that show, the car they drive, the clothes they wear, the places they're eating, the vacations they're taking, it would likely cost 20 to 25% more than those positions actually pay. So when you step back, no one taught us about personal finance. There's been a proliferation of financial products, as there have been every product. You know, like you go to the grocery store to buy your toothpaste and you can't find it, or the drugstore, because they've got a new flavor or size, or it's the same thing in all areas. And then the third is these unrealistic media images. And so this was such a long answer, because I feel like this is that root cause. And when you can start to understand, it's not, I didn't say it's because the math is hard. I didn't say, it's because of these external forces, I believe, and so many factors that we're struggling, and budgeting is so hard.
So Manisha, in your Money Zen blog, you wrote about some common savings myths. Could you share them with us?
Yeah, so I think there are three big myths that I'd like to highlight. The first one is I can only save a little bit of money, so why even bother? And the way I think about that is, you know, let's say you're rushing out to work, and your husband or your child wants a hug. Would you say, I only have a few seconds, so I'm not going to give you a hug? No. And it's the same thing with savings. And probably the best example I can give you is to just contrast two situations. So just to keep the numbers simple, I'll use round numbers. If, say, you're 25 years old and you are hyper diligent about savings, you set aside 20% of your income, so you're saving $5,000 a year, you're nearly maxing out your 401k or your IRA, and you start at 25 and you do that every year until you're 65. And if you earn 6 to 7% returns by the time you're 65, saving $5,000 a year starting at 25, you'll have $1 million. If you wait until my age, you're in your mid-40s, you start at 45, which is when most people start thinking about it, to have $1 million, you would either need to earn returns higher than 6 or 7%, or you'd have to save $25,000 a year. So every $1 you're saving in your 20s is 4 to 5 times more powerful than a dollar in your 40s. And you may say, well, okay, that's great, because my 20s were 20 years ago, or 30 years ago, or 40 years ago. Here's the key: we are living so much longer. A dollar in your 40s saved is 5 times more powerful than a dollar you start saving in your 60s. A dollar in your 50s is 5 times becomes more powerful than a dollar you start saving. So it moves forward. So small amounts can make a huge difference because of the power of compounding. And I used 5,000, which is a huge number. But if it's 500, if it's whatever you can afford, it's like a snowball that starts rolling forward. The second myth comes back to something Pam said early on about being the mother of teenagers, and that is that good parenting is to give your kids everything that you didn't have, and that is the most natural human response to want to make sure that your kids don't feel the pain that you may have felt. The problem is we have experienced a bit of supersizing in parenting lately. The USDA keeps track of how much it costs to raise a child from 0 to 18. I have no idea why it's the Department of Agriculture that keeps the stat. But the number keeps going up. And right now, a child born last year will cost mom and dad $210,000 to raise to age 18. And that's average. And that is before you add in college. And I've noticed since I've started citing that number, I think when I first started citing it, it was like $160,000 a year. I mean, still a huge number, but it's growing. And so I think that the point that I want to make there is one of the best gifts that you can give your children is the understanding of financial limits and that things aren't boundless. And whether it's with the smaller things, clothes and electronics when they're in junior high and high school, or the bigger things with financial education. It is so painful to say no, but I from a financial standpoint, it's one of the best gifts that you can give, not to hurt your whole family's finances at the expense of not letting your kids have to work for it and earn it. And then the third myth, I would say, is the one that I alluded to before, which is that budgeting is about deprivation. And the way I think about this is framed by a book called Your Money or Your Life that was written back in the early 1990s. And I read that book when I was in my 20s, and it changed my life. And what struck me was this concept. The author said, how do you get money? Most of us don't have it rain down on our heads. We had to go work for it. And so when we earn money, we are, in a sense, exchanging our life's energy to get that income. So when we spend that money, what we're actually spending is our life's energy. And the authors had a really neat concept, which was to say, take your annual income and divide by 2,000. 2,000 is the average number of hours somebody works in a year. It's 50 weeks a year, 40 hours a week. So if you're earning $40,000 a year divided by 2,000, you're earning $20 an hour before tax. Now, if you're out and you see something that costs $200, or your teenager sees something that costs $200, you can do the math. You can take that hourly wage, divide the item by that amount, $200 divided by 20, 10 hours for that item. Now you have a metric that you can use to decide how bad do you want it, that's linked to something more tangible than money. It's the energy that you put out into the universe to earn that money. And so I think when you can make the flip in terms of thinking about budgeting to maximizing, making sure that your hard-earned energy is going towards the things in life that bring you and your family the most joy, it can completely transform how you think about money. And so I think that's the third myth, Pam.
Can I translate the hours work to like running the dishwasher and the washing machine and folding laundry? I'm going to take that one home with me.
Absolutely.
So if they're the savings myths, are there any absolute spending truths that you can give us to help make budgeting easier?
So one of the things, I love rules of thumb, just some kind of touchstone that you can rub up against. And so in my endless quest to not be a size 10 or 12, which I'm constantly bouncing in between, I have paid a lot of attention to food. And comes to eating, we have a food pyramid, or now the dinner plate. So I may not always adhere to the right mix of proteins and carbs and so forth. I at least know, and when I'm off the reservation, when I got the Häagen-Dazs and the spoon in my hand, I know that I'm going overloading on the dairy. The thing that we're missing in personal finance is the financial equivalent of that. Something to let us know, are we off the reservation? And the single best rule of thumb that I have ever seen comes from a woman, Elizabeth Warren, who is now a senator. She helped get the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau up and running, and prior to that, she was a professor of bankruptcy at Harvard Law, and at that time, she and her daughter wrote a book called All Your Worth, which stemmed from then Professor Warren's work looking at families that went bankrupt and trying to figure out what went wrong. Usually it was a medical expense that caused people to go over the edge. But the other factor that she noticed was that individuals had no wiggle room in their budget. And so she tried to study and say, what does healthy spending look like? And if everything that I tell you here today, if you take nothing away but these three numbers, this alone could be transformative. 50, 30, 20. 50% is the, in an ideal world, is the amount of your take-home pay that would go towards needs. 30% would go towards wants. And 20% would go towards savings. Now, when I say that 20% number, most people want to throw spitballs at me because, I mean, that just sounds, it sounds like somebody telling me I could be a size two. Like, not going to happen. But the idea behind this is it gives you something to strive towards. And let me explain that 20% savings number. The idea behind that is at least 10% of your income is going towards retirement savings, and then another 10% would be for nearer term needs, and that could be, depending on your stage of life, anything from, you know, if you're in the early stages saving for graduate school, as you're approaching retirement, you may decide that you want to put that money towards long-term care or disability insurance. So that 20% isn't all going into a long-term piggy bank. 10% is retirement, the other 5 to 10% are nearer term needs. But that framework can then help you. If you're saving 1% or you're not saving at all, then you can use that framework to say, okay, I'm clearly out of balance somewhere. Is it my needs or is it my wants? And we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But 50, 30, 20 to be sort of your financial food pyramid can be an amazingly simple and powerful place to start in terms of rules of thumb.
And how should we actually track our spending?
So I still track the old-fashioned way. I mean, I literally have in my wallet a piece of paper. And every time I buy something, I'm at the checkout counter, or I'm online paying a bill, I whip out the piece of paper and I write down the amount. This system takes me about 15 minutes, literally. Like, it's 2 or 3 seconds at the point that I'm doing something, and at the end of the month, I tally it all up. And I put it in a spreadsheet. Most people say hearing that makes them want to hurl. Like, that just sounds so profoundly unpleasant. I put that out there because I just want to say it doesn't have to be a sophisticated system. I literally have been tracking with pen and paper since 1991 when I first started doing this. Thankfully, there are now all kinds of neat technological services that you can use to make this process a lot simpler. The next step up would be just tracking it on your smartphone as you spend something in the notes feature. But then you can get even more sophisticated than that. There are some new services, and they run the gamut. Two that I like that start with the letter M. One is called Mint.com, M-I-N-T.com. And the way it works is you link up all of your bank accounts, your credit cards and so forth, to your Mint account. And then as you're spending off any of these different avenues, it gets captured. And you can log on and you can see exactly what you're doing. Another service that it's still in beta, but I think this is really neat. It's called Movin, M-O-V-E-N. And how this works is some people felt uncomfortable with having all of their financial information fed into an aggregator. And so at Move-In, the way it works is you decide to put all of your spending on one card, and then that card is tracked. And you pay it off, so you can't carry a revolving balance. It's just like a charge card. You charge during the month, and you pay it off at the end of the month. It's or like a debit card. It'll just withdraw right at the point of purchase. But the neat thing about this is it gives you real-time updates. So you can program and say, you know, I know my spending, my weakness is red velvet cupcakes. And so every time I buy a red velvet cupcake, I'm going to put it in there, and it's going to let me know when I hit a certain dollar amount a month and when I'm getting closer to that, or groceries or food out or whatever the category is. And so it'll literally let you know you're at Starbucks. Okay, as you put it in, it'll tell you are already 90% of the way through your month's allotment for coffee purchases. Are you sure you want to still do this? So those are some ways that you can use to track your spending. A third bucket that you can do, if that feels too micromanaging, is to start from the big picture and just say, first of all, how much am I saving? If you're already saving 20%, you could say, you know, clearly I'm doing something right, so I don't need to do any budgeting. If you're not there, then what you can do is look at big categories. So you can take a look, and let me backtrack. Let's say you have no idea how much you're spending. That's how most people feel. It's just like you oftentimes have no idea how much you're actually eating. And in this case, what you can do is add up all the money you spend on credit cards. So literally you're looking at the end of the month at the aggregate number. Then you take a look at all the checks you wrote that month. Then you take a look in aggregate at all that you put or took out in cash. So you're just looking at the sources of spending and adding it up in aggregate. That is a really simple, easy place to start. Then you'll know at least how much you're spending, and you can compare that to your income. And then gradually, as it feels comfortable, just like if you're exercising, you don't start out in a Zumba class being able to do all the moves. You start out at a level one, and then you build up and build up. Same thing with budgeting. So start with the broad categories if it feels really overwhelming to begin with.
So, Manisha, what if you're someone that's just starting out and you have competing demands for your cash? How do you prioritize?
So there are seven steps that I think are helpful to think about competing demands on your cash, which is the place most of us are in. And the first step is to always make the minimum monthly payment on any outstanding debt you have, student loans, credit cards, car payments, home payments. And the reason for that is to protect your credit score. So you always want to make at least the minimum payment on time, in full. And that's because your credit score, which is a three-digit number that summarizes how financially responsible you are, determines all kinds of things, not just the money that you can, not just the price that a bank will lend you money to buy a home at, but increasingly even things like insurance companies are looking at your credit score, saying, you know, if you're responsible with your money, you might be a responsible driver, a responsible homeowner, so we'll lower your property and casualty premiums. Employers in certain industries may ask you for your permission to check your credit score, particularly if you're working with money in any industry, or if you're working in financial services, that may happen. So even your job could be impacted. So step number one is to pay your bills on time, because 35% of your credit score is determined by one simple thing, which is, do you pay your bills on time? So it'll save you a lot of heartache, just that one simple step. Step number two is to strive to have at least a $2,000 emergency fund. And the reason for that is, according to the Consumer Federation of America, on average, that's the amount, $2,000, of unexpected expenses that the average person has in a year. So you're paying your bills on time, step one. Step two, you're building a $2,000 emergency fund. Step three and four can be interchanged depending on how you feel about it. I'd like to try and do them in tandem if possible. Step three is to contribute to your employer's plan at least up until the point of the match. And the reason for that is that the match is free money. And so at least getting your contribution to that level gives you a guaranteed return, which is something you can't get anywhere in the markets. Step four, which some people prefer to do ahead of step three, is if you have any double-digit credit card debt, to accelerate the payments on that. If you're struggling with credit card debt, the two books that I think are the most helpful in this are Gene Chatsky's book, Pay It Down, and Dave Ramsey's book, The Total Money Makeover. And both of them basically, in an essence, will tell you this formula. If you have $5,000 or less of credit card debt, and you can add an extra $50 a month to that credit card debt, depending on your interest rate, you can get it all paid off in 3 to 6 years by adding the extra $50 to the minimum monthly payment. If you have between $5,000 and $10,000 of credit card debt, what you want to do is add an extra $100 a month. If it's over $10,000, you want to try and find some place to cut back to add an extra $150 a month. And again, depending on your interest rate, by doing the minimum plus those additional amounts every month, you'll have the debt paid off in 3 to 6 years. Step five is to keep building your emergency fund. So let me just repeat. Step one was to minimum payments on all debt. Step two, build the $2,000 emergency fund. Step three, contribute to your employer's retirement plan up to the match. Step four, if you have double-digit credit card debt or private student loans, to pay off an additional $50, $100, or $150 a month, depending on what level you have. Step five is to continue to build your emergency fund. People will say, how big should it be? The classic rule of thumb is 3 to 6 months. If you have two income household and it's steady income, you can get by with less, because if something happens to one of you, the other one can step in. So you can be closer to the 3 month end. If you're a one income household, which increasingly women in America were statistically were divorced, were widowed, were single parents, you want to be closer to 6 months. That's the standard rule of thumb. The truth is that getting to a six-month emergency fund, it's tossed around as if that's something that you can do in a year or two. I mean, it takes years to build up to that. And so I want to just say, if you're listening to that and thinking, I am nowhere close to that, it's a long-term process of building that up. And that's why I was saying, of that 20% that you're trying to save, 10% is retirement, but another 10% is to start building up that emergency fund and that fund for nearer-term needs. Step six, if you're ready to buy a home, that is the point at which it makes sense to start saving for a down payment. You've dealt with all of the debt. You've got a solid emergency fund. And then step seven is if you already have a home or you don't want to buy a home, then you can keep building up that savings cushion. And so that's a simple framework that you can use to think about competing demands on cash. And if you make it to step seven, you are in financial nirvana. So I don't mean to imply that that's like a really simple list to go through. Most people tend to live between steps one and four. But I wanted to give you kind of the full range so that when you're in that place where you're feeling really financially strong, you know what comes in those outposts. Yeah, so I'll repeat the question. It's a great one. Where the heck do you put that $2,000 emergency fund? Honestly, I think the best place to put it is at your bank in a savings account. You don't want
it at Beneficial Bank.
You don't want to put it in a checking account because the temptation is too hard. You want it to be difficult to get to, separated. And you don't want to put it, you don't want to invest it. That's a really important point. Investing is something that you want to do with money that you don't need to touch for at least 5 to 10 years. Before you start stepping into stocks and bonds, you need to know that you don't have to touch that money for a long period of time. So it has the time to weather the natural ups and downs. So the last thing you want to do with an emergency fund is put it into stocks or bonds. You you might consider short-term CDs, but interest rates are so low right now that honestly you're not going to be getting that much more. I'd rather you have the flexibility that if a tire blows and you need to get $400 out of there, you can get it easily. So honestly, a simple savings account, by keeping that $2,000 liquid, easily available, then you are in a better position to be more aggressive with the money that's in your retirement account, in other places, because you know I can breathe if something goes wrong. And it's okay that my retirement money is bouncing around, because that's what stocks and bonds do as they grow, because my day-to-day life isn't going to change because I immunized it. I protected myself by having that emergency fund in that savings account.
So, Manisha, can we go back to that step seven again as far as retirement? Because that's where I have a lot of fear, because I want to retire someday. Are there budgeting principles I should be looking to?
Yes, and I'm hesitating because if I haven't depressed you already, this next bit probably really will be the least uplifting piece of information that I give you today. But I'm going to tell you because at least if you know where to head. Retirement is something that I think is going to have to financially be redefined, in the sense that when the concept of retirement first came up, we worked until 65 and we retired, and then we were dead in 2 or 3 years. I mean, literally, years ago, I mean, we worked until nearly the end of our lifespan. Today, what happens if you retire at 65? You quite literally, especially all of us because we're women, you could live 20, 30, 40 years in retirement. So if you think about that, that means for every year that you are working, you not only have to take the money that you earn from that year of working to support your life, which as we've already discussed is hard enough as it is, but you have to set aside enough money to support a year or so of living in the future. So think about that. Out of your income for this year, you need to not only be able to support yourself for 1 year of living today, but you're going to need to support yourself for anywhere from 10 to 40 years of living in retirement. That's mind-boggling. And so that's the reason that we're having a retirement crisis right now, is that the math, the number of years that we're retiring or trying to be able to fund in retirement, is large. If you want to fully fund, this is the gold standard. This is, you don't have to worry about anything, and very few people are here. But the gold standard of retiring would be to say you have 25 times the amount that you need to spend a year in savings. So let's just say you need to spend, let's say that you need to spend $50,000 a year in order to maintain your standard of living. The first thing you do is subtract the Social Security, and there's a lot of debate about whether you should still include Social Security in your estimates. If you're over the age of 35, I am still including it in projections. So let's assume that, I'm just going to use very big numbers, you've been working your entire career, you've paid into Social Security the entire time, and you're going to get $2,000 a month. Not all women do. The average benefit for women is just over $1,000 because many of us take time out of the workforce. But if you work constantly all the way through, $2,000 a month, so I'm going to use round numbers, $25,000. So you take you take $50,000, you subtract $25,000 because that's what you're getting, and now you need $25,000 a year times 25 years. That's how you would come up with what is the gold standard. And the mathematical basis of that is something called the 4% rule, which says that you can spend 4% of your portfolio a year and have exceptionally high odds of not running out of your money. So 25 times whatever the dollar amount is after Social Security and any other pension income that you may have coming in is the gold standard of how much you need to save for retirement. Most people are not anywhere near there, and that's okay, because that assumes a lot of things. That assumes that your spending level stays exactly the same in retirement. Odds are you're not going to be spending as much when you're 90 as you did immediately after retirement when you start traveling and spending time with grandkids and other sorts of things. But that gives you a sense of the magnitude. In terms of saving, there's two other things that I would highlight. what do you need to know about your portfolio, about your investments? I think there are three numbers that everybody wants to know about their, that everyone should know about their portfolio. The first one is, what is your asset allocation? What is, and that's just fancy financial speak for mix between stocks, bonds, and cash. That single decision, the mix between stocks, bonds, and cash, will drive, honestly, 80% of your long-run returns. So you want to get that right. How much do you put in those categories? The best rule of thumb I've heard comes from John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard. And he says, take your age, put that in bonds. Take the rest, put it in stocks. That's a great baseline. And then you can tweak. If you're more conservative or more aggressive, you can adjust from there. But if you're 50 years old, you'd have 50% in bonds and you'd have 50% in stocks. If you're 40 years old, you'd have 40% in bonds, 60% in stocks. That's a good, rough place to start. So you want to know your asset allocation in your retirement portfolio, whether that's your IRA or your 401k or your 403b or 457. The second thing you want to know are the fees you're paying. And you can... we'll talk about that in more detail later, but you can find that out by talking, if you're at an employer-based plan, talking to the benefits department and getting the expense ratio. If you have an IRA with a standalone financial institution, you can ask them, can you explain to me what is my expense ratio? And I'll come back to this, but the rough rule of thumb is I like to see fees at 1.5% or less. And then the last piece that you want to know is, what is your ability, willingness, and need to take risk? And that is a way of saying, in an ideal world, you don't want to take more risk than you absolutely have to. So how do you know how much you need to take? There are three metrics. Your ability to take risk depends on how long your time horizon is. If you have a 40-year plus time horizon, you can hold a whole lot more stocks and riskier investments than if you're going to need to spend that money in the next 10 years. So the first question you ask yourself is, when do I need to spend the money? The longer the time horizon, the more you can have in stocks. The second question is, what is my willingness to take on risk? And that relates to just the mental fortitude, how you would feel if your portfolio is jiggling around. The stronger the stomach, the more in stocks you can have. And then the final component is, what is your need to take risk? And that's basically saying, what kind of return do you need in order to get as close to 25 times your income to have that gold standard of retirement? And if you're looking to figure out how to calculate that, there's a website called bankrate.com. And if you type in Google bankrate financial calculators, all kinds of awesome calculators will pop up. How long it takes to pay off your student loans, your credit cards, if you can afford to buy a home, how much car you can buy, and how much you need to be saving for retirement given different levels of potential returns. You can put in your age, how much you're saving, how much you already have in a nest egg, and the calculator will help you see what kind of return you need to get where you're wanting to go. One other last website I'll mention, as you approach retirement, there's a website called FireCalc, FireCalc. You can take your total portfolio value at FireCalc and you put it in. Let's say you've got 300, you're 64 years old, you've got $300,000 of savings. You put it in there, and then there's a place where you can change two assumptions: how long you need that money to last and how much you want to be spending a year. With those three numbers, your portfolio, how long you want it to last, how much you need to spend from it a year, the program runs like 3,000 iterations, and it will tell you, statistically speaking, what are the odds that you will not run out of money. And then you can play around with that by lowering your spending, or if you've got very high odds of not running out of money, you can increase your spending. So FireCalc.com is a neat portfolio to really see how close you are to retiring.
So you just gave us a whole lot of metrics and numbers,
yeah.
And I know I'm a banker, but do I need a financial advisor too?
So this is the way I think about financial advice. It's like coloring your hair. There are times when I just color my own hair because it's L'Oreal preference and I'm worth it and it's easy and it's quick. And then there are times when I'm doing something where I really feel like I want a professional to do it. And I feel like it's the same. It's not good or bad. It's different. Let me start by saying, I believe that the benefit of a financial advisor is not in helping you find the next hot investment. I think the benefit of a financial advisor is helping us save ourselves from ourselves. In other words, the thing that impacts us most are habits that may be detrimental that we're not aware of. In other words, we're in our 30s, we're in our 40s, we're in our 50s, we're in our peak earnings years, and we're not saving enough. A financial advisor who can run the calculations for you and say, you need to save an extra $3,000 or $5,000 or $7,000 a year in order to get to your goals, and can tell you that while you're in your 40s or 50s, rather than when you're 64 or 72 and you're already in retirement or approaching it, that is priceless advice. The other thing that financial advisors can do that I think is really important is make sure that you don't have too much or too little in stocks or bonds, and that you're not spending too much in fees. The downside of financial advisors is they cost money. And so you always want to be weighing the cost and the benefit of the two. In general, when it comes to any kind of financial advice, I like to see everything all in be 1.5% or less. And let me explain. Typically, if you're working with a financial advisor, they will either earn money based on commissions, on salary from the firm they work for, or as a percent of your assets under management. Then on top of that, a financial advisor will suggest investments, and those investments will also have costs. So whenever you're working with an advisor, you always want to ask, what are the two levels of costs? The cost to use the advisor and the cost of the investments that they are going to be putting you in. And you want the combination of those two to be 1.5% or less. And what's interesting is I found that a lot of people feel really awkward about asking a financial advisor about the cost of fees. And I want to tell you, any good financial advisor will be thrilled that you are asking them that. So don't ever, it's your money, don't ever hesitate. And a really good litmus test is if you ask someone the question, if they look you in the eye and can answer it right back with confidence, that's generally a good sign. If somebody is really reluctant or gives you a very complicated answer to it, it's not a difficult question. There are two levels of fees. They should be able to spell it right out for you. Now, where do you go to get financial advice? There are a number of different organizations that you can go to. The firms that I tend to recommend are big entities like Vanguard, known for very, very low cost, Schwab, Fidelity. You can go to these organizations, and depending on your asset levels, they have different tiers of service that you can get. At most of these firms, the advice, the people giving the advice in most situations are on salary, so there is truly no cost, direct cost to you. There's indirect cost in the sense that the investments that they sell ultimately are the things that are generating the revenues to pay for these people's salary, but there's not a direct cost to you. And they can help you create the right portfolio. Increasingly, there have been internet-based companies that have sprung up that are really targeting the $500,000 and below market. So anybody from somebody with $1,000 to somebody with $500,000, there's a website called Betterment, like Better Your Investments, BETTERMENT.com, and I love them. You go there and they will give you high quality, low cost advice on how to pick your asset allocation. Another place that you can go is NAPFA.org, the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, .org, or Garrett with two R's and two T's, Garrett Planning Network, which is started by a woman, Cheryl Garrett, and it's a clearinghouse of hourly financial planners, so somebody that you may pay $100 or $150 an hour to, who will sit down and tell you what to do with your investments, and then or help you with a debt management plan, or help you decide if you can afford to buy a home or a car, or how to fund college, and you pay them by the hour, and then you take the actions on your own. So those are some options for financial advice.
Any other books or blogs?
So on books, I, of course, like to recommend On My Own Two Feet, which is the book that I co-wrote. I can't say enough about your money or your life, especially on this topic of building a better budget. it's $11 on Amazon, and it truly can transform your mindset and help you live more mindfully and spend more consciously, and to me, really increase your joy. One of my favorite things that they say in the book, you know, keep track of everything that you're spending. We were talking earlier about how do you budget. If you, another simple way that I got from Your Money or Your Life, you write down everything that you spend each month, and then when you're trying to figure out how to find some extra money to save, take out a highlighter and literally just highlight anything that didn't bring you joy. So it could be drinks with people you don't even like, or, you know, food out that's making you fat. And you can start to find these categories of things that you can stop spending on, and you don't lose any joy because they weren't making you happy. So that's another one. And then the last one I'd recommend is called Can I Retire? It's a teeny tiny book that was self-published by an accountant named Michael Piper, who I think is just whip smart. It is probably the best book I've read on retirement. It's like 100 pages, and it walks through that whole long answer I was giving about the 25 times and subtracting your Social Security. It's all in this book, Can I Retire by Michael Piper. You can get it on Amazon. And in terms of blogs, there's a woman from Pennsylvania, Amanda Steinberg, who is just amazing, and she founded a company called Daily Worth, and they send out daily financial empowerment emails to women. So there's a twofer there. It's Pennsylvania and it's a woman. And so the blog that I always like to recommend is dailyworth.com. And if you're really interested in investing, there's a site called Get Rich Slowly that has good information. And then twice a month I also write about personal finance, and my blog is at MoneyZen, moneyzen.com.
So, Manisha, we're almost out of time, and we've covered an awful lot of ground. Is there one piece of summary advice that you can give us to help us see our relationship with money more clearly?
I think the number one thing I want people to know is personal finance can be such a private and internal struggle. And in my firm, I deal with people who have $1 million to $25 million in assets. And you might think, like, what on earth could these people be worried about? What I have found is it doesn't matter if you're making $30,000 a year and spending $35,000, or if you're making $300,000 a year and you're spending $350,000. If you spend more than you earn, which is the place the vast majority of us are in because we didn't learn about personal finance, there are so many product options out there can make our head spin, and we are bombarded by those darn unrealistic media images that it's really easy to spend more than you are making. And that is the state that the vast majority of people I meet are in, and it doesn't matter what income bracket, what part of the country, gender, ethnicity, it crosses all, it's the universal struggle that we all have. So if you are struggling, I just want you to know you're not alone. And probably the most powerful piece of advice I can give to you from this session is threefold. One, to remember to start, to the extent that you can, to think about the process of budgeting as maximizing your joy, that hard-earned energy you put in to earn that money. You're just making sure that you're getting every bit of as much pleasure as you possibly can out of it. That's the sole purpose of budgeting, that you are going to question unrealistic media images. From now on, every TV show, movie, magazine ad you see, you'll look at that and think, is that really possible? With that salary, can you really look like that and live like that? And then the final piece of advice is that 50-30-20. If you can remember Elizabeth Warren's healthy spending formula, 50% wants, 30% needs, 20% savings, knowing about 10% of that is going for retirement. The other 10%, I'm calling savings loosely. It could be for anything from paying down college loans to saving for long-term care insurance, nearer-term needs. 50-30-20. With a new balanced mindset around spending and a critical eye at media images can really change your financial life.
Great information, excellent book. And if at this time anybody had a few questions, I think we have one.
So this question is about the John Bogle rule of thumb, which was saying you take your age, you put it in bonds, the difference goes in stocks. And the question was, in stocks there are various categories, growth, value, large, small, that seem fairly clear, but bonds feel kind of murky. Do you hold them till they mature? Do you buy bond funds? This is an excellent question. I met a woman recently who she and her husband had saved an enormous amount. They'd managed to save $2 million, and they took that and on a very modest salary. They took it to a financial institution, and they said, we want to put this into municipal bonds because we've heard that's safe. And they got put into the worst credit quality tranche of municipal bonds, and they lost almost half. So the key thing to know about fixed income is that you want it to, you don't want to be taking credit risk and interest rate risk with your fixed income. Or if you are taking that risk, be really clear why you are taking it. So to that end, you can do that with both individual bonds and bond funds. But the thing that you want to be researching and understanding is what credit risk am I taking on and what interest rate risk am I taking on with these. And ideally, you want to keep your interest rate short and your credit quality as high as possible, whether it's individual bonds or bond funds.
Well, thank you so much for having a financial conversation with us today. Could everybody give Manisha a hand? Enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you so much for coming.
And to your financial future.